And now we begin the life of Srinivas Acharya. Srinivas Acharya was one of the most important Vaishnava teachers in the generation immediately following Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He is chiefly remembered as the illustrious disciple of both Gopal Bhatta Goswami and Jiva Goswami, and his achievements include leading the very first book distribution party in the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, converting to the Vaishnava religion King Birambir, the powerful Mala king of Vana Vishnupur, originating the Manohar Shoy style of kirtan, developing elaborate techniques for Manjari sadhana, and co-organizing the first Gaurpurnim festival, the birth anniversary of Sri Chaitanya, which was held at Keturi with Narottam Thakur, Shamananda, and thousands of other Vaishnavas. The story of Srinivas begins years before his birth with a pious Brahmin named Gangadhar Bhattacharya and his wife Lakshmi Priya, who lived in the small village of Chakundi on the eastern bank of the Ganges. They were to become Srinivas's parents. However, before his birth, they felt themselves unfortunate because, by the will of Providence, they had remained without offspring for many years. Gangadhar was a great devotee of Mahaprabhu and spent a good deal of his time hearing and retelling the stories of the great golden avatar. This predicted incarnation of Sri Sri Radha and Krishna had recently appeared in Navadvip and was performing pastimes or lila with his intimate associates. Gangadhar Bhattacharya desired to do more than just talk about these things, but due to social and familial pressures, he inwardly resolved to meditate in separation. In the year 1510, however, he could not tolerate it any longer, and he decided to travel to Navadvip to see the Lord of his life. En route, he had to pass through Katwa, which is some 7 miles from Chakundi, and while there, he learned that Nimai of Nadia, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, was in that very village taking sannyas, the renounced order of life. "What?" exclaimed Gangadhar. "Why must my Lord take to the renounced order? This austerity is especially reserved for human beings like myself, so we can overcome our attachments to this world. Certainly there is no need for Sri Nimai, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to live the harsh life of an ascetic." But Gangadhar Bhattacharya's reservations were mixed with excitement, for Mahaprabhu was now in proximity and Gangadhar would get to see his Lord face to face. When Gangadhar approached the holy area where Sri Nimai was taking sannyas, he saw the Lord's intimate associates, Nityananda Prabhu, Chandrasekhar Acharya, Sri Mukunda Dutt, and many others. He saw Madhu Shiel, the barber, preparing to cut Nimai's beautiful locks of raven black hair. "No, please stop," said the onlookers. They, like Gangadhar, could not conceive of the Lord in the renounced order of life, nor did they relish seeing him in that condition. Even Madhu, who had the good fortune to touch the Lord's head, could only cut his hair out of duty, while weeping profusely. Madhu and the others were well aware that the Lord has made up his mind, wanting to set an example for the entire religious world and to stress the importance of renunciation. There was nothing they could do. By the time Keshava Bharati, the sannyas guru, had uttered Nimai's new sannyas name, Sri Krishna Chaitanya, the crowds were in a state of shock. Beautiful Nimai is really taking sannyas. They believed their eyes, from which tears were now incessantly flowing. But the deed was done. Madhu, the barber, fainted in disbelief. did he shave the Lord's head? It was as if he were controlled by the Lord's own hand to fulfill the Lord's own inexplicable desire. Whatever had actually occurred, Nimai Pandit was now a sannyasi named Sri Krishna Chaitanya. Gangadhar was particularly moved by what he had seen, and yet all he could do was repeat to himself, "Chaitanya, Chaitanya, Chaitanya." His eyes pleaded with everyone present as he tried to understand what had just transpired. But all he could do was mutter in a stupor of mixed emotions, "Chaitanya, Chaitanya." Keshava Bhatati's words resounded in his head over and over. Soon, Gangadhar found himself calling aloud, "Chaitanya, Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Sri Krishna Chaitanya," with uncontrollable enthusiasm. Somehow, the transcendental sadness and happiness mixed together to create an especially volatile spiritual emotion. Gangadhar was mesmerized, half mad with ecstasy, as he returned to Chakandigram, constantly repeating, "Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Chaitanya, Chaitanya." He explained to his wife what had happened at Katwa, and she too was overcome with ecstasy. As the days passed, their ecstasy increased, and the whole town of Chakandi came to marvel at Gangadhar's vital transformation. In fact, upon seeing his uncontrollable absorption in Sri Chaitanya's name, which was contagious, his wife and the villagers of Chakandi gave him a new nickname, Chaitanya Das. Chaitanya Das was obsessed with Sri Chaitanya. In order to see the Lord, he and his wife planned a trip to Jagannath Puri, where the Lord had journeyed after accepting the renounced order. When the couple arrived in Puri, they immediately went to Sri Chaitanya and surrendered at his feet. At that time, the Lord showed them special mercy, saying, "Lord Jagannath is very happy that you have come here. Go to the temple and see his deity form. The lotus-eyed Lord is extremely merciful, so please go to see him." Following Sri Chaitanya's order, Chaitanya Das and his wife, together with Govinda, Mahaprabhu's personal servant, quickly ran to the temple where they offered many prayers at the feet of Lord Jagannath. Weeping tears of divine love, the happy Brahmin couple were soon escorted from the temple and given luxuriant accommodations by the arrangement of Sri Chaitanya. They then spent several happy days with Sri Chaitanya in Jagannath Puri. One day, Mahaprabhu told his servant, "Govinda, although Chaitanya Das and his wife have not mentioned it to me, they would like to have a child. They admitted this in front of Lord Jagannath, from whom I am non-different. They have sincerely prayed, and I know their hearts. The desired offspring will soon appear, and Srinivas will be his name. He will be a greatly beautiful child. Through Rupa and Sanatan, I will manifest the Bhakti Shastras. Through Srinivas, all of these scriptures will be distributed. Let that Brahmin and his wife quickly return to Chakandi." The couple returned to Chakandi and conceived a child, a beautiful baby boy. They named him Srinivas. The exact year of his birth is now unknown, for none of the authorized biographical sources mention it. Nonetheless, at least five prominent theories exist, placing his birth as early as 1517 AD or as late as 1585. Since Srinivas was acquainted with many of Lord Chaitanya's direct associates, especially Narahari Sarkar, who was Mahaprabhu's senior contemporary, there is little doubt that the later dates attributed to his birth are quite untenable, since Narahari had by that time passed away. The truth probably lay somewhere in the middle, closer to the earlier dates, perhaps two decades prior to Mahaprabhu's disappearance in 1534. It is generally accepted by the orthodox tradition that the earliest of Srinivas Acharya's alleged birth dates are more accurate, since Srinivas was senior to both Narottam and Shyamananda. Their exact birth dates are also unknown, but what is known is that they were born just around the time of Mahaprabhu's disappearance. Moreover, as Srinivas Acharya's story unfolds, it becomes clear that he was a young man at the time of Mahaprabhu's disappearance. Thus, it is likely that Srinivas was roughly 15 to 20 years of age in 1534. Modern scholarship seems to hold that Srinivas Acharya was born in the second or third decade of the 16th century, or perhaps a little earlier. It is known that he was born on the auspicious full moon day of the month of Vaishakha, or April-May, and that his Brahmin parents were overjoyed with their special son. Lakshmi Priya's father, Balaram Vipra, was a learned astrologer, and he informed the happy couple that their son was a Mahapurush, or a divinely empowered individual. Bhakti Ratnakar records Balaram Vipra's findings, quote, "On the full moon day of Vaishakha month, in the constellation of Rohini, when all the stars are aligned in the most beneficial way, Lakshmi Priya, the wife of Chaitanya Das, gave birth to a son who will be a great devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu." Unquote. In fact, the boy's bodily luster was just like molten gold and thus reminiscent of Lord Chaitanya. He had a long, elegant nose. His beautiful eyes extended like huge lotuses. He had a broad chest and arms extending down to his knees, also like Lord Chaitanya. This much is described in the first chapters of both the Bhakti Ratnakar and the Prema Vilas. According to custom, Chaitanya Das and Lakshmi Priya immediately gave charity to the Brahmins and delighted in the blessings that these Brahmins offered their child. In pursuance of these blessings, Lakshmi Priya would constantly and prayerfully sing Gaur Kirtan into the child's ears. The melodious sounds of his mother's prayers made Srinivas joyful, and as he grew day by day, he learned to chant the names of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and of Radha and Krishna. Soon this small crescent moon, known as Srinivas, grew into his full brilliant form, and he was known as the brightest and most beautiful boy in all of Chakhandi. He studied under the famed Dhananjaya Vidya Vachaspati, who taught him all the branches of Vedic learning, including religion, logic, poetry, political science, grammar, Ayurveda, and other well-known sciences of the time. However, according to the third chapter of Prema Vilas, Dhananjaya Vidya Vachaspati admitted that he had nothing to teach Srinivas. He said, "This boy knows more than I could ever hope to learn." Moreover, Prema Vilas relates that the goddess of education appeared to Srinivas in a dream and told him that she would personally make him proficient in all areas of learning and that he would especially master the scriptures. Still, Srinivas became known as Dhananjaya Vidya Vachaspati's prize pupil, and as such, he was the pride of Chakhandi without any rival. He was loved by all the townspeople, who saw him as a precious gem. Due to Srinivas's popularity, he came in contact with Narahari Sarkar of nearby Srikanda, who was Lord Chaitanya's intimate associate. Because of Narahari Sarkar's intense devotion, he was allowed to sing glorification of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Mahaprabhu's presence, even though out of humility the Lord dismissed anyone else who would sing his glories. This distinction, bestowed upon Narahari by Mahaprabhu himself, impressed Srinivas, who consequently accepted Sri Narahari as his first instructing guru. According to all authorized sources, after young Srinivas met Narahari Sarkar, the boy began to exhibit ecstatic symptoms. Narahari had a profound effect upon him, giving him spiritual instructions and telling him that he should go to Puri to see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. As Srinivas was thinking of going to Puri, his father became ill, and after 7 days of fever, passed away from this mortal world. It was a great shock to the family, and Srinivas did all that was possible to console his aggrieved mother. Meanwhile, the omniscient Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu prepared his associates for Srinivas's arrival. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had written to Rupa, Sanatan, and Gopal Bhatta, requesting them to train Srinivas in spiritual life. Sri Chaitanya also asked Gadadhar Pandit to teach Srinivas the Bhagavad on his arrival in Jagannath Puri. Narahari Sakur advised Srinivas to see to his mother's care and maintenance in Jajagram, where her father, Balaram Vipra, and her brothers resided, having moved from Chakandi. Moreover, Narahari insisted that Srinivas proceed to Puri in order to associate with Sri Chaitanya. At this time, Srinivas asked Narahari to initiate him into the chanting of Krishna's name, but Narahari told him that Mahaprabhu desired that he eventually take initiation from Gopal Bhatta Goswami. Still a young boy, Srinivas traveled with a companion to Puri, but according to Karnananda, during the journey he found out about Sri Chaitanya's untimely departure from this world. When he first heard this devastating news, he was prepared to commit suicide by setting his body on fire. However, both Sri Chaitanya and Nityananda Prabhu, who, according to some, had also passed away by this time, appeared to Srinivas on the pretext of a dream and consoled him. The phrase Shopna Chale, or on the pretext of a dream, appears frequently in Bengali literature of the period and is usually taken to mean within the context of a spiritual vision. Despite such visions, however, Srinivas remained grief-stricken as he made his way to the Gopinath temple in Puri to take shelter of Gadadhar Pandit. The Pandit was overcome with intense separation as well, and tears kept flowing from his eyes like torrents of rain. Srinivas himself was traumatized, but he managed to bow down reverentially at Sri Gadadhar's feet. After introducing himself, he noticed that Gadadhar Pandit's mood had changed. He said, "I am glad that you have come and introduced yourself. Just before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu passed away, he instructed me to teach you the Bhagavatam. He knew that you would arrive in Puri one day and he asked me to explain Krishna Leela to you." Although Gadadhar Pandit now rejoiced in the prospect of fulfilling one of Mahaprabhu's last desires, he was suddenly overcome once again with grief. He said, "I cannot teach you Bhagavatam at this time, O young Srinivas, for the manuscript in my possession has now become illegible due to the profusion of tears that I have cried on its pages." Historian D.C. Sen writes that the manuscript was mostly effaced by Chaitanya's own tears. Apparently, Mahaprabhu had given the manuscript to Gadadhar, but before doing so, he had cried upon its pages when he read of Radha and Krishna's separation. Srinivas touched the sacred book to his head reverentially and began to experience ecstatic symptoms. Nonetheless, the problem of studying a book that had been rendered illegible remained. Both Sri Gadadhar and Srinivas would not be swayed from their purpose. The will of Mahaprabhu that Srinivas study the Bhagavatam under Gadadhar Pandit could not be obstructed, that is, if indeed it was the Lord's will. In an attempt to fulfill this divine decree, Sri Gadadhar sent a message to Narahari Sarkar in Bengal, requesting him to secure another manuscript of Srimad Bhagavatam, which he could then use to instruct the enthusiastic young Srinivas. Narahari replied that another copy was available and that a messenger should immediately be dispatched to receive the book. At Gadadhar's request, Srinivas himself was sent back to Bengal to get the Bhagavatam. Sri Gadadhar told him to hurry as separation from Mahaprabhu was intolerable for him, and he did not know how long he could remain in this world. However, before leaving Puri for Bengal, Srinivas fulfilled a long-cherished desire to see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's direct associates by going to the homes of Ramananda Roy, Sikhi Mahiti, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, Bhakweshwar Pandit, Paramananda Puri, Gopinath Acharya, and many others. He also went to see King Prataparudra, but according to Bhakti Ratnakar, the king had gone away to lament in solitude the Lord's passing. By seeing Srinivas, all of the great personalities in Puri were reminded of Sri Chaitanya. By observing Srinivas's intense and unprecedented love of Godhead, the devotees could understand that he was Gaur Shakti, or the embodiment of the energy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Actually, Prema Vilas concludes that Srinivas is an incarnation of Mahaprabhu's ecstasy. The intimate associates could naturally perceive this and could immediately understand that through Srinivas, the eternal message of Sri Chaitanya, the esoteric message of the Vedic literature, would be widely distributed. If Mahaprabhu had broken open the storehouse of love of God, and the Goswamis had taken that nectar and placed it in tangible vessels, Srinivas would then see that these vessels were properly circulated among all sincere souls. Perceiving this, all the intimate associates of Mahaprabhu gave Srinivas important instructions and advice for carrying on the mission. When Srinivas arrived in Bengal and received the copy of the Bhagavatam from Narahari Sarkar Thakur, he heard of Gadadhar Pandit's passing away. This was a terrible blow, and Srinivas, now lamenting in separation, did not return to Puri. According to other authoritative versions, he didn't find out about Gadadhar's passing until he returned to Puri. Whichever version is correct, Gadadhar Pandit appeared to him on the pretext of a dream and encouraged him to go forward. At that time, Srinivas reflected on the inconceivable will of the Lord. Why did he take away the personality who was to teach him the Bhagavatam? Was there a new plan? Was someone else to teach him the sacred scriptures? In fact, he would soon study under Jiva Goswami, the most respected scholar in all of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. The original plan of studying under Gadadhar Pandit was meant to entice him, to whet his appetite, and to make him mad with the mood of separation toward the Lord and his devotees. Some say that Srinivas fell despondent at this time, but not much is known about the ensuing months or years that followed Sri Gadadhar's passing from this world. It is generally assumed that Srinivas spent this time at first in a heartbroken state and then in serious meditation and study. There is no account of his life for the next several years in the available biographies. The books by Karnapur, Narottam, and Nrsingadev Kaviraj may have recorded it, but we have not yet been able to trace them entirely, except passages quoted in contemporary and later writings. He seems to have continued his studies, as he was still in his teens. When Sri Janava Devi, the wife of Nityananda Prabhu, went to Vrindavan, Rupa Goswami asked her to send Srinivas from Bengal to Vrindavan as soon as possible. On her return to Bengal, she asked Narahari to do this, as Rupa was waiting to train him. It was Sri Chaitanya's command to the Goswamis of Braja to train Srinivas, and Narahari advised him to hasten so that the command should not be violated. This request seems to have heightened Srinivas's desire to study bhakti literature with Rupa and Sanatan Goswamis. But he was still staying at home. Had he gone to Vrindavan then, he would have met Rupa and Sanatan. But instead he resolved to visit the homes of Sri Chaitanya's principal associates on the way, halting at Navadvip to visit Sri Chaitanya's home. This is the second time that young Srinivas had behaved in this way, first with Gadadhar Pandit and now with Rupa and Sanatan. Perhaps Srinivas's enthusiasm to associate with Sri Chaitanya's direct followers in Puri and Navadvip was so overwhelming that he was unable to heed the sagacious advice of his forebears. Some say that all of this was the will of Providence, so that Srinivas would take initiation from Gopal Bhatta Goswami. Others opine that Srinivas, by his example, was merely teaching something about the unequivocal importance of sacred pilgrimage and the association of devotees. Whatever the case, Srinivas was enthralled with the home of Sri Chaitanya in Navadvip or Mayapur, where he met Vishnu Priya Devi, the Lord's revered widow, and her esteemed servants, Bamsivadana Thakur and Ishan Prabhu. They all blessed Srinivas, and he stayed with them for several days, hearing the pastimes of Sri Chaitanya. During those few days, he watched Vishnu Priya perform severe austerities. For example, she would chant the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, over each grain of rice in her possession. When she was finished with her daily chanting, she would eat only the grains she had set aside with each mantra. Truly, Srinivas said, this is a wife who is worthy of Sri Chaitanya. Srinivas also met Damodar Pandit, Shuklambar, Murari Gupta, and other early friends and intimates of Sri Chaitanya in Navadvip. From there, Srinivas went to nearby Shantipur, where he met Sri Advaita's wife, Sita Thakurani, and her two sons, Achyuta and Gopal. In the Talukdara edition of Prema Vilas, it is stated that Srinivas went to Shantipur only 3 years after the departure of Advaita Acharya. But the Vidyaratna edition states that it was 13 years after Sri Advaita's holy departure. The latter calculation seems more in keeping with the bulk of biographical information available about Sri Advaita's life and times. After Srinivas was warmly greeted by Sita Thakurani and her sons, he visited the house of Nityananda Prabhu and Kardaha, where Janabadevi, her son, Birabhadra, and others greeted Srinivas as if he were part of their own family. But Janabadevi encouraged him to start for Vrindavan without delay, because Rupa and Sanatan would soon rejoin the Lord in the spiritual world. On the way to Vrindavan, Srinivas stopped at the well-known Abhiram Thakur's house in Kanakul, Krishnanagar, to deliver a letter from Janabadevi. Upon his arrival, the Thakur greeted him with three loving lashes from an extraordinary whip. This whip, known as Jai Mangal, had the peculiar effect of bestowing love of God on anyone it touched. Sri Abhiram's strange greeting was actually a benediction. According to some, Jai Mangal is actually a bamboo rod, more like a magic wand than a whip. Both Abhiram and his wife Malini showed the deepest affection for Srinivas. Not only did they bless him with their famous whip, but they gave him valuable instructions and reiterated the importance of going to Vrindavan as soon as possible. While continuing his journey, Srinivas stopped in Katwa, where his father had witnessed Mahaprabhu adopt the renounced order of life. Next, he passed through Agradvip, where the three famous Ghosh brothers, Vasudev, Govinda, and Madhava, had established their temple, and then he proceeded to Ekachakra, the birthplace of Nityananda Prabhu. Finally, Srinivas made one last stop in Jajigram to say farewell to his aging mother, Lakshmi Priya, and to once again visit Narahari Sarkar, whom he considered his beloved guru. Narahari was concerned about Srinivas's delay in going to Vrindavan, and he asked him to leave immediately. Otherwise, said Narahari, you may not get your heart's desire to study the bhakti scriptures with Rupa and Sanatan. And so, without any further distraction, Srinivas determinedly set out for Braja. By this time, Srinivas had achieved full adulthood. Dr. Sambidananda Das suggests that Srinivas had gone to Vrindavan for the first time in the mid-1550s, when he was in his early to mid-30s. Dr. Das gives elaborate evidence to support his views. Meanwhile, Sanatan Goswami had left this mortal world, and Rupa Goswami could not bear the separation. Sri Rupa felt that he, too, might not survive to instruct Srinivas, and so he asked his distinguished disciple and nephew, Jiva Goswami, to care for Srinivas when he would come to Vrindavan. Traveling in those days, mostly by foot, was difficult. Nonetheless, Srinivas was making determined progress, stopping briefly on the way in Benares to visit the house of Chandrasekhar Acharya, where previously Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had lived for 2 months. Here, Srinivas met an elderly disciple of Chandrasekhar, who invited him for a meal and showed him the places associated with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Next, Srinivas reached Prayag, currently known as Allahabad, and spent the night there. 4 days before arriving in Vrindavan, he heard that Sanatan had passed away some 4 months earlier. Moreover, when he reached Mathura, he learned that Rupa Goswami had passed away only 3 days before. Hearing this, Srinivas fell to the ground, crying like a madman. He felt that he was the most unfortunate person in the entire universe. Every step, from his proposed meeting with Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to his studying the Bhagavatam with Gadadhar Pandit, to his meeting with Rupa and Sanatan, had all failed. Srinivas sat beneath a tree and wished for his own death. Just then, Rupa and Sanatan appeared to Srinivas on the pretext of a dream, and they told him that he was the embodiment of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's love. They encouraged him to proceed to Vrindavan and take shelter of Gopal Bhatta Goswami and to study under Sri Jiva with all of his life and soul. Hearing the words of Sri Sanatan and Rupa relieved Srinivas's heavy heart to some extent. He was now able to travel, and soon he felt the dust of Vrindavan beneath his feet. His anguish now mitigated, he approached Rupa Goswami's Govindadev temple, hoping to find greater solace in Lord Govinda's lotus feet. Bhakti Ratnakar describes that as Srinivas sat in trance before the deity, Jiva Goswami and his many followers entered the temple. Srinivas immediately recognized the famous Goswami, and after introducing himself, was greeted by Sri Jiva with great warmth and loving hospitality. Sri Jiva brought Srinivas to his Sri Sri Radha Damodar Mandir and gave him comfortable lodging for the night. The next day, Srinivas expressed his homage at the tomb of Sri Rupa in the courtyard of Jiva Goswami's temple. Then Jiva introduced him to Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who greeted him with kind words but openly expressed his regret that Srinivas could not have arrived sooner, for Rupa and Sanatan had been anxious to meet him. Gopal Bhatta then took Srinivas to his Radharaman temple, where he asked the deities to bless Vrindavan's newly arrived pilgrim. According to the 6th chapter of the Prema Vilas, Gopal Bhatta Goswami revealed to Srinivas at this time that he, Srinivas, is Mani Manjari in the spiritual realm. Gopal Bhatta also told him that in this eternal spiritual identity, upon which he should now consistently meditate, he will always assist Guna Manjari, or Gopal Bhatta himself, who is also known as Ananga Manjari, in her service to Sri Sri Radha and Krishna. This was to be his inner meditation from that day, and this would lead Srinivas to the perfection of self-realization. Gopal Bhatta Goswami explained to him that this mode of devotional service is called Ragatmaka Bhajan. After revealing these confidential truths, Gopal Bhatta Goswami and Jiva Goswami gradually introduced Srinivas to all the inhabitants of Braja. Gopal Bhatta and Jiva Goswami taught Srinivas well, and Gopal Bhatta even initiated Srinivas as Mahaprabhu had decreed. Since Jiva Goswami was the preeminent Vaishnava philosopher of the period, Gopal Bhatta directed his disciple, Srinivas, to Sri Jiva for higher instruction. It may be remembered that this was the expressed desire of Rupa Sanatan. In fact, Premavilas makes it clear that it was Sri Jiva who personally took care of Srinivas and gave him a thorough spiritual education. Another young scholar, the illustrious Narottam, had already been placed under Jiva's tutelage. Narottam was originally initiated by Lokanath Goswami, but was sent by Lokanath to Sri Jiva for additional spiritual instructions. Narottam had been studying under Jiva for 1 year when Srinivas arrived in Vrindavan. Then young Duki Krishnadas came as well, being sent by his guru, Hridoy Chaitanya. These three young men, Srinivas, Narottam, and Duki Krishnadas, studied under Jiva Goswami with the utmost enthusiasm and became the Goswami's best students. They were widely known as inseparable friends. Jiva Goswami ordered his three pupils to study the forests of Vrindavan with Raghava Pandit, who, as an incarnation of the intimate gopi, Dhanishta, in Krishna's pastimes, knew all the sacred groves as well as their significance for the bhakti movement. Bhakti Ratnakar dedicates 5 long chapters, the entire 5th wave, which comes to 3,937 Bengali couplets, to the wanderings of Raghava Pandit with Narottam and Srinivas throughout the 64 kroshas of Mathura Mandala. These pilgrimages are enunciated as a detailed science with references to theology, morphology, and ontology. Duki Krishnadas accompanied them on pilgrimage according to some accounts, but according to others, he joined them afterwards. As time went on, Srinivas, Narottam, and Duki Krishnadas were given a special mission. They were to distribute the books of the Goswamis, the Bhakti Ras scriptures, especially in Bengal, where Vaishnavism was widely embraced, but where its underpinning in philosophical literature was wanting. Janava Devi had visited Rupa and Sanatan in Vrindavan some years earlier and was well aware of the prolific spiritual literature that the Vrindavan Goswamis were producing. So she contacted Jiva Goswami and suggested that the books be sent to Bengal. To comply with her wishes, Sri Jiva summoned his three best men. In a large assembly of Vaishnavas, Sri Jiva called forth Narottam Das and said, "From this day forward, you will be known as Narottam Thakur Mahashoy." Then he called Srinivas and said, "You will be known as Srinivas Acharya." And finally to Duki Krishnadas he said, "Because you have brought pleasure to Srimati Radharani, you will be known as Shyamananda." After giving him these titles, Sri Jiva told him of their traveling Sankirtan mission to Bengal, Orissa, and other provinces of India. The distinguished triumvirate did not want to leave the holy land of Vrindavan, but they fully understood the importance of their divine mission. They went to their initiating gurus, who gave their blessings, and this instilled in them the necessary enthusiasm to begin. When they returned to Sri Jiva, they found him making preparations for the lengthy and arduous journey that lay before them. These were, after all, his three best students, and he would spare no pains for their welfare. Sri Jiva engaged a rich merchant disciple from Mathura by having him supply a huge, spacious cart, 4 strong bullocks, and 10 armed guards. The manuscripts, original works by Rupa, Sanatan, Gopal Bhatta, Raghunath Das, and Jiva, among others, were carefully placed in a large wooden chest, which was bolted and covered with a special wax cloth. Some say that the enclosed manuscripts were the only existing copies of these works, and so Sri Jiva was fastidious in packing them and in choosing the appropriate men to accompany them. Others say that Jiva had engaged scribes to make copies, but still the books were valuable, having only 1 or 2 alternate editions. Sri Jiva also secured a special passport from the king of Jaipur, which the 3 Vaishnav heroes needed to show as they traveled to various regions of eastern India. After thorough preparation, Srinivas, Narottam, and Shyamananda left Vrindavan. As they commenced their journey toward Mathura, several devotees, including Sri Jiva, accompanied them, unable to bear being separated. As the caravan neared Agra, the well-wishers fell behind. Now their journey was underway. There could be no turning back. Soon they reached a small town known in those times as Itta, and then they traveled a path through the Chota Nagpur jungles, also known as the Jarakanda forest. Leaving Magadesh on their left, they arrived in Tamluk, where they camped for the night. After many months of travel, they approached the land of Godadesh, or Bengal. Confident that their mission was nearing completion, they decided to rest in a small village named Gopalpur, just within the boundaries of the Mala kingdom of Vana Vishnupur. Here, the priceless cargo of books was stolen. The king's dacoits were following Srinivas, Narottam, and Shyamananda for some time, carefully surveying the well-protected cart of priceless manuscripts from afar. According to Bhakti Ratnakar, they had planned to rob the caravan for quite a distance, keeping it under strict surveillance, but they tactfully waited until it reached the jurisdiction of their own Raja's kingdom. The court dacoit soon detected that only 15 men accompanied the cart, 10 armed soldiers, 3 holy men, and 2 cart men. The caravan held special interest for the thieves because the king's astrologers had prophesied that the cart contained a precious treasure. The band of dacoits, now numbering over 200, inflamed each other's imagination while discussing one of the astrologers' exact words. "This cart is filled with gems that are more valuable than gold." Excited by the possibility of an enormous fortune, they were about to overtake the caravan in a village named Tamar, but circumstance did not permit it. The marauders stealthily follow them through the town of Raghunathpur and through Panchavati as well. Finally, in Gopalpur, the Vaishnav saints spent the night near a beautiful lake, confident that their mission was nearly completed. The dark night and luminous stars were the only witnesses to the surreptitious theft of the manuscripts, as all 15 men slept deeply due to their arduous journey. When they awoke, it was as if their worst nightmare had come to pass. The loss of this priceless treasure was the most terrible scenario. The 3 stalwarts could not contain their tears, but Srinivas, the senior man in the party, advised the other 2, Narottam and Shyamananda, to dry their eyes and to proceed with their mission of bringing the message of the 6 Goswamis to various parts of Bengal and Orissa. Srinivas made it his own solemn duty to retrieve the manuscripts. Before doing anything, however, he wrote to Jiva Goswami and told him all that had transpired. As Srinivas was writing his letter some miles away, King Birambir was rummaging through the treasures stolen from various travelers. Just then, his servants appeared with the court's most recent acquisition, Srinivas's carefully wrapped chest of the most precious gems. Birumba dropped everything else and feverishly unwrapped his latest prize. After having heard the prophecies, he could scarcely imagine what splendors awaited him. In one suspenseful moment, he removed the cloth covering and opened the trunk to reveal mere manuscripts. Oh, what a shock! Where was the priceless treasure? Lifting out the top manuscript in disbelief, the king saw the signature Sri Rupa Goswami written on a palm leaf. When he examined further and saw Sri Rupa's beautiful exposition of Vaishnava philosophy, he felt something change deep within himself. According to the Gaura Prasad Charitavali, Birambir attained love for Krishna at that moment. He then reverentially returned the book to the trunk and retired for the evening, aware of the grave sin that he had foolishly instigated. As the king rested, he had an unusual dream. He saw a beautiful and effulgent person whose body was filled with divine energy. With a loving smile, that person spoke to him, "Do not worry. Soon I will come to Vishnupur and we shall meet. I will retrieve my manuscripts and you will be relieved of all sinful reactions. At that time your joy will be boundless. Know for certain that you are my eternal servant life after life, and I am your eternal well-wisher." The next morning the king awoke and started his life anew, waiting for the day when his mysterious dream would come true. Meanwhile, Srinivasacharya made his way to the outskirts of Vishnupur, where he met a Brahmin resident named Sri Krishna Ballabha. The two pundits became friends, and Krishna Ballabha graciously invited Srinivas to be a guest in his home. Gradually, he realized Srinivas's exalted position and surrendered to him as a pupil. In due course, Krishna Ballabha mentioned that the king regularly convened a Bhagavatam study group for all who were interested. Srinivas was extremely curious as to the nature of the Bhagavatam presentation and asked Krishna Ballabha to take him to the next meeting. When they arrived, Vyasacharya, the court pundit, was reciting and commenting upon the Bhagavatam. Srinivas was unimpressed, but he said nothing. The next day, they arrived again, and this time, too, Vyasacharya was pontificating in the same fashion. After 2 weeks of the court pundit's intolerable display, Srinivas could not contain himself, and so after the meeting, he spoke to Vyasacharya. He said, "You, sir, do not follow the text, nor are your commentaries in line with Sridhar Swami or the other standard exponents of Bhagavat philosophy." Vyasacharya listened to Srinivas's comments, but ignored his advice. However, the king, who was nearby, overheard what was said and found it interesting. The next day at the recital, Vyasacharya again attempted to elucidate the esoteric section of the Bhagavatam that delineates Sri Krishna's Rasalila. Respectful but firm, Srinivas interrupted with a question. He said, "Sir, how can you comment on such confidential subjects without referring to the authoritative statements of Sridhar Swami? You are obviously unfamiliar with his work." Vyasacharya now became angry. He didn't like being challenged in front of his sycophantic assembly, who were accustomed only to his peculiar rendition of Bhagavatam commentary. Before another word was said, however, the king, who was in the audience, began to defend Srinivas's position. He said, "How is it that this Brahmin scholar finds fault with your explanations? Perhaps your interpretations are questionable." To this, the arrogant Vyasacharya replied, "Who can interpret the text better than I? This newcomer is an upstart, and he dares to question me in the presence of your majesty." Then he turned to Srinivas and indignantly quipped, "If you are such an authority on the Bhagavatam, why don't you come sit here and explain these same verses in a more brilliant way?" Srinivas rose to the challenge. He recited the Bhagavatam verses in the most melodious style, and then he spontaneously commented upon them with great verve and authority. He drew upon all existing Vaishnava explanations, and yet offered his own unique presentation. No one had ever heard such a masterful enunciation of Bhagavat philosophy. The king encouraged him to go on, allowing him to speak for several hours. When he finished, the whole assembly applauded and were ecstatic with Srinivas's contagious love for Krishna. Vyasacharya could not believe his ears. He was defeated, but he was happy. King Birambir was greatly moved and spoke to Srinivas. He said, "No one has ever come to this kingdom and shared so much love and scholarship in the way that you have. Please tell me your name, and from where do you come?" Srinivas replied, "My name is Srinivas, and I am a native of this country, Bengal. I came here to see your magnificent court and to relish the Bhagavatam." The king then gave him the best accommodations in the palace and asked him to stay as long as he liked. Later that evening, the king asked Srinivas to dine with him, but Srinivas said that he took only one humble meal per day and that he had already eaten. Nonetheless, Birambir encouraged him to have some fruit, and he complied, not wanting to offend his distinguished host. As Srinivas ate his fruit, the king sat at his side like a humble servant. He had never felt this way about anyone. Srinivas was that effulgent person who had appeared in his dream, his guru, and he wanted to render some menial service. That night, Birambir heard Srinivas repeating the name of Krishna through the wall, since his room was right next to the one in which he had his honored guest stay. It seemed as though Srinivas did not sleep. "Here is a genuine saint," thought the king. "He is simply absorbed in the name of God." With this pleasant idea, the king fell asleep, listening to Srinivas Acharya's blissful voice in the next room. The following day in the great assembly, Srinivas again spoke from the Bhagavatam. Once again, the eager, expectant audience relished every word. Srinivas astonished all who listened. Chroniclers of the event have reported that, quote, "even the stone walls of the hall seemed to melt at the pathos," unquote. Srinivas spoke with enough erudition, sensitivity, and devotion to honor his Vaishnava predecessors, and all who were present agreed that the wisdom of the orator far exceeded his years. One by one, people came and bowed to Srinivas's feet, hoping he would accept them as his disciples. Later, the king submitted himself to Srinivas as a lowly beggar. He said, "You are the real king, for you have love for Krishna. I am not even worthy to be in your presence." Srinivas, with all humility at his command, merely shook his head. He was not able to accept his own exalted position. But the king persisted, saying, "Allow me to be your servant, please." Anxious to know Srinivas's internal purpose, the king implored him, "How can I serve you? My entire kingdom is at your disposal." Srinivas replied, "I came from the holy city of Vrindavan with a mission from Gopal Bhatta Goswami and Jiva Goswami. I was to bring their original literature to Bengal, but this treasure was, unfortunately, robbed within your kingdom. If I cannot retrieve these books, I would prefer to lose my life. Can you help me get them back?" The remorseful king burst into tears and said, "A poor worm am I, lost hopelessly in this land of birth and death. My own men have pillaged for years and years under my order, and then they came upon your caravan. We were told it was the greatest treasure in the universe, and we naturally pursued it. I cannot express my sorrow." Then, reflecting for a moment, the king said, "But there is a positive side to all this. Our meeting would not have taken place if all of these events had not occurred. I would commit these sins again and again for but a moment of your association." Srinivas laughingly reassured him that such sinful life was unnecessary for attaining his association. In fact, Srinivas told him that sinful life was an obstacle to spiritual progress. Srinivas then forgave the king for all the sins he had committed, but asked him to sin no more. Grateful for Srinivas's mercy, the king led him to the room where his treasures were kept, and there Srinivas saw the trunk with the Gosvami literature. At that moment, Srinivas experienced ecstatic symptoms, and as a merciful gesture, he took the garland of flowers from his own neck and placed it on King Birhambir. Srinivas then asked the king to bring him tulsi leaves, flower garlands, sandalwood paste, and other paraphernalia for worshipping the sacred books. The king brought him everything, and with rapt attention, he watched Srinivas perform the elaborate initiation ceremony that followed. By reciting the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, in the king's ear, Srinivas initiated him. According to the Prema Vilas, Srinivas gave him the name Hari Charan Das. Later in that same work, it is said that Jiva Goswami eventually showed the king special mercy by writing a letter in which he renamed him Chaitanya Das. The king's wife, Queen Sulakshana, and their son, Prince Dari Hambir, also became Srinivas Acharya's surrendered servants. The queen's initiated name is unknown, but the boy was named Gopal Das. Krishna Ballabha and Vyasacharya also became dedicated disciples. Whether or not Srinivas initiated all of these great souls on this or his second visit to Vishnupur is a matter of controversy. Vishnupur soon became a great center of Vaishnavism. The initiation of the king and his loyal subjects was an epoch-making event in the history of the Gaudiya tradition. In all of India, it was only in Vana Vishnupur that Gaudiya Vaishnav culture and art developed without any foreign or distracting influence. Even the Muslim intrusion was minimal. Consequently, the architectural and sculptural art of Bengal from the beginning of the 17th century onwards is nowhere found in such abundance and in such pristine form as in the Vaishnav monuments of Vishnupur. This is one of the many virtues of royal patronage. King Birhambir reigned from 1596 to 1622, and at that time he wrote many devotional songs in praise of Krishna, Mahaprabhu, and Srinivas Acharya. Much of his exquisite poetry can today be found in Bhakti Ratnakar and in Pada Kalpataru. The king's mellifluous voice, reflected in his literary work, assisted in his newfound task of spreading Vaishnav teaching throughout his domain. In this he was quite successful. Srinivas had thus accomplished his mission in Vishnupur, and when he wrote to Jiva Goswami, informing him that the books had not only been retrieved, but that the main bandit, a king, had taken up the banner of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, all of Vrindavan rejoiced and sang the glories of Srinivas Acharya. Other important events occurred during this period. For example, although King Birhambir and his entire kingdom were now converted to Vaishnavism and Srinivas was in the process of developing an important center there, the Acharya needed to again see his dear friends Narottam and Shyamananda. He had written to them of the developments in Vishnupur, but he knew little of their activities. Furthermore, he had heard that Narahari Sarkar Thakur was ill and preparing to die, and so he wanted to go to Srikanda to see him as well as his own aging mother in nearby Jajagram. In addition, Srinivas's marriage occurred around this same time. Bidding his leave of King Birhambir, Srinivas took the chest of books to Jajigram. Upon arrival there, he told the devotees exactly what had transpired. All of the holy town's inhabitants, especially his loving mother, rejoiced in his company. But they had some heartbreaking news for him as well. They told him that Srimati Vishnupriya had passed away from this world. This was Sri Chaitanya's widow, whom Srinivas had met, and who had since become an important personality in the preaching mission of Bengal. When Srinivas heard of her demise, he was in a state of profound remorse. Unable to control his emotion, he fainted. Such was his love for the intimate associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The Jajigram devotees did their best to revive and console Srinivas, and after some time, he recovered. A few days later, a message came from Narahari Sarkar and Raghunandan Thakur requesting Srinivas to come to nearby Srikanda. Srinivas immediately left to see his two well-wishers, who had guided him so nicely in his youth. It was during this meeting that Narahari Sarkar suggested that Srinivas take a wife. Sri Narahari said, "Your mother is a great devotee. She has for many years been rendering valuable service in Jajigram. You should fulfill whatever small desire she might have. Personally, I know for a fact that she would be very happy to see you married. Since she is a great devotee, you should comply with her wishes." On the advice of Sri Narahari, Srinivas resolved that he would soon marry and raise a family. After spending a few more days in Srikanda, he traveled to Kantak Nagara in order to visit the great sage Gadadhar Das, who was one of the personal associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. When Srinivas arrived, Gadadhar Das embraced him with intense affection. He asked Srinivas about the devotees of Vrindavan, especially the Goswamis. He was curious about the welfare of all the great Vaishnavas. How were they able to exist in separation from the Lord and his confidential devotees? Where were they living and under what conditions? In this way, Gadadhar Das and Srinivas discussed the subject of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the plight of his devotees in his absence. After several days in the association of Gadadhar Das, Srinivas was scheduled to return to Jajigram. Before leaving, however, Gadadhar Das blessed him, saying, "One day you will taste the nectar of congregational chanting in the company of the Lord Himself and in the company of His intimate associates. For now you have my blessings to go and marry. May it bring you all auspiciousness." The words of Gadadhar Das touched Srinivas deeply, and meditating on their import, he returned to Jajigram. There he met Gopal Chakravarti, an elderly Brahmin who had a beautiful and devoted daughter named Draupadi. Observing that Srinivas and Draupadi were naturally attracted to each other, Sri Raghunandan Thakur, out of concern for Srinivas, arranged the wedding. After the marriage, Draupadi came to be called Ishvari. Some say it was her initiated name, honoring her own steadfast devotion to God and acknowledging her marriage to a great saint. Her father, Gopal Chakravarti, soon accepted Srinivas as his spiritual master, as did her two brothers, Shyamdas and Ramachandra. Srinivas quickly became one of the most prominent gurus in all of Bengal. After some time, his wife gave birth to a son, and when he wrote to Jiva Goswami in Vrindavan about the blessed event, he received an exuberant reply in which Jiva named the boy Vrindavan Balaba. Soon after, Srinivas married again. Polygamy was not uncommon in Srinivas's time, but it was rarely encouraged. His second wife was also a great devotee, and after initiation, she was known as Gauranga Priya, although her name at birth was Padmavati. One may wonder why Srinivas found it necessary to take a second wife. Most of the standard biographies do not elaborate, stating merely that the second marriage followed the first one by a few years. But the Anuraga Bali informs us that his most intimate disciples insisted that he remarry upon the untimely death of his two sons from Ishvari. Apparently, they were concerned that his bloodline should not die out. It seems that Srinivas had two sons, Vrindavan Ballabha and Radhakrishna Das, who are said to have died at a young age. They are not listed as having any disciples. The others, his first wife, her daughters, Hemalata, Krishnapriya, and Kanchan, also known as Yamuna, and his second wife, Gauranga Priya, and her son, Gati Govinda, had hosts of disciples. Today, there is also a continuation of Srinivasa's bloodline from Gati Govinda in Vrindavan. Meanwhile, Narahari Sarkar Thakur took his final breath after seeing Srinivas one last time. Srinivas organized a massive festival in order to properly honor Narahari's memory. Everyone from Srikanda and from neighboring villages attended. Vaishnav festivals soon proliferated in the region. For example, Srinivas started an important preaching center in Barkuli by installing the deity of Radha Vinod, or Krishna, in the house of one of his prominent disciples, Govinda Chakravarti. Such installation ceremonies were accompanied by elaborate festivities, including singing, dancing, and distributing sacred food or prasadam. It was through this method that the movement was spread throughout Bengal. Before elaborating upon Srinivasa's second sojourn to Vrindavan, it would be appropriate to describe some of his important disciples, especially because Ramchandra Kaviraj, one of his most renowned followers, had accompanied him on this second trip to Vraja. Ramchandra was considered Srinivasa's other eye and other arm. They were so close that they were considered as one soul. Ramchandra and his famous brother, Sri Govinda, who was also a disciple, were the sons of Chiranjiva Sen, Mahaprabhu's intimate associate. Both were celebrated scholars, artists, and poets, but Ramchandra came to be widely accepted as Srinivasa's most noteworthy disciple. This was in some measure due to Narottam Das Thakur, who, at Srinivasa's request, took charge of Ramchandra and forged an intimate friendship while schooling him in all the details of Vaishnava philosophy. With the active help of King Birambir, Srinivas successfully expanded his area of preaching in Bengal to the districts of Birbhum, Bankura, Burdwan, and as far as Tripura in the east. It would not be hyperbole to declare that he evangelized all of Bengal and converted hundreds to become his disciples. Premavilas alone specifically names 117 direct initiated disciples hailing from every corner of Gaudadesh. Even though Srinivas had hundreds of disciples, 21 of them were considered prominent in four basic categories. The first category, six Chakravartis, Gokulananda, Govinda, Narayan, Sridas, Shyamadas, and Vyasacharya. The second category, eight Kavirajas, Bhagavan, Gokul, Gopi Ramana, Govinda, Karnapur, Nrsinga, Ramachandra, and Balabi. Category 3, six Thakurs, Jayaram, Kumudananda, Kularaj, Radhabalabha Mandala, Ramakrishna Chaturaj, Rupa Ghataka, and Thakur Das. And one Raja, King Birambir. To this list, Harinarayan, King of Shikarambhumi, is often added, as is Hemalata Thakurani, Srinivasa's daughter. Although she is not often counted among his disciples, being a blood relation, she was nonetheless properly initiated by him and one of his most significant followers. A highly educated and vigorous preacher, she has been compared to Janava Devi in spreading the movement throughout Bengal. She was a gifted and devoted leader, initiating both men and women into the Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition. One of her disciples, Yadunandan Thakur, became a famous scholar and poet, composing simple Bengali versifications of classic Gaudiya literature. Moreover, he wrote Karnananda, among other works, at Hemalata Thakurani's specific request. She eventually married a great devotee named Kopi Janabalaba Chattaraj and had several children. Today, her descendants are living in the villages of Malyati and Budaipad in the Murshidabad district, where in her own time she had personally revolutionized the preaching of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Srinivas's second journey to Vrindavan, mentioned earlier, in which he was accompanied by Ramchandra Kaviraj and also by his son, Vrindavan Balabha, is important for a number of reasons. First, Srinivas had not been there since his recovery of the bhakti literature. All of the Goswamis were thus anxious to show their appreciation, and when Srinivas arrived, they did so in full glory. Further, he now came to Vrindavan with Ramchandra Kaviraj, or according to some, Ramchandra met him there soon after he arrived, a good example for the Vrindavan Goswamis to see. For such a worthy disciple evidenced Srinivas's capabilities as a preacher. Consequently, Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who had initially wanted Srinivas to take over the worship of the Radha Raman deity in Vrindavan, gave the duty instead to his other disciple, Gopinath Pujari, and he insisted that Srinivas continue his excellent preaching mission in Bengal. The descendants of Gopinath's brothers are still in charge of the Radha Raman temple. Another reason that Srinivas's return trip to Vrindavan was important was because Shamananda Pandit had returned there at approximately the same time, enabling them to deepen their friendship. Together, they resumed their studies under Jiva Goswami, who taught them further esoteric secrets of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Gradually, Srinivas began to reveal his mystic potency, and it became apparent that he was fully absorbed in the mood of Manjari Bhava, or the highest intimacy of love of God. After several months in Vrindavan, Srinivas, along with Shamananda and Ramachandra Kaviraj, returned to Bengal because the missionary work there was incomplete and was encouraged by Sri Jiva and the other Vrindavan Goswamis. Stopping in Vana Vishnupur, they went to see King Birambir, who was delighted by the presence of his guru and the other two Vaishnav luminaries. The king's devotion was reflected throughout the kingdom. In the words of D.C. Sen, quote, Raja Birambir would not do anything without the advice of his guru, Srinivas Acharya, even in political matters. His, Srinivas's, voice prevailed alike in the court and in the domestic circles of Vishnupur. We find that repeating the name of God a fixed number of times was made compulsory by penal law in the state. Sacrifice of animals at the altar of the gods was also discountenanced, though not actually prohibited by law. Worldly dignity attended the guru who had brought spiritual glory to the country. We find that on every occasion of Vaishnava festivities of any importance, valuable presents were given to Srinivas, while Raja Birambir was ever ready to minister to his physical comforts in every possible manner. But true to the traditions of a Brahmin scholar and saint, Srinivas contented himself with living in a straw-roofed hut, though he might have built palaces with the help of the Raja and other influential disciples. The money he received was mainly spent in feeding his disciples, of whom there was always a large number residing at his house. Unquote. The pervasiveness of Vaishnav Dharma in Bengal, and particularly in Vishnupur, lasted well after the time of Srinivas and into the following centuries. For example, King Birambir's successor, Raghunath Singh I, eventually built numerous Vaishnav temples in many distant villages in order to make Vaishnav religion popular with the tribal people of those localities. In fact, the kings of Vishnupur, from the time of Birambir onward, assumed considerable responsibility for the material and spiritual well-being of their subjects. They contributed ample endowments for the maintenance of shrines and other religious institutions. Not only did they request all citizens living within the jurisdiction to chant the holy name, as noted by D.C. Sen, but they introduced an extensive system of espionage to see whether their subjects were observing the prescribed religious obligation. To this end, King Gopal Singh, in the subsequent generation, used to go out in disguise in order to detect whether his subjects were actually repeating the names of God while chanting on their japa, rosary-like beads. In this connection, however, the Vishnupur kings were far from merciless. Most of their subjects readily complied with their religious mandate. Others, who did not, were obviously disinclined to live in a Vaishnav community, and as much in consideration for them as for the state, the authorities asked them to leave. According to Dr. Sambidananda Das, quote, "In short, the Vaishnav kings, from Birambir downwards, developed Vaishnav culture in all its branches. The practical religious lives of the kings, particularly Birambir, Gopal Singh, and Chaitanya Singh, made the people of Vishnupur God-fearing, virtuous, humble, courteous in manner, and pure in heart. It is not an easy matter to make the whole population happy and pious. The standard of morality of these Vaishnav people was judged by more than two distinguished foreigners. The people regarded their kings as their gurus. To this day, it is their custom to offer edibles to Sri Chaitanya's altar in the name of the king on the occasion of public worship. Thus did Srinivas, through Raja Birambir, start a new epoch in the religious life of the country." While in Vishnupur, Srinivas showed the highest level of Krishna consciousness. He was an exemplary Gaustiyanandi, a preacher, as is evidenced by his traveling Sankirtan party and by his enthusiasm to spread the bona fide message of the Bhagavatam to all who would listen. He was also an excellent Bhajanandi, an inner worshipper, as is seen by his absorption in Manjari Bhava, or his inner meditation on his ontological form as a maidservant of Srimati Radharani. In this connection, one interesting story, among many others, is related in all of Srinivas's authorized biographies. Once, while in Vanavishnupur, Srinivas fell into a trance while meditating on his form as Manimanjari in the spiritual realm. As he fixed his mind on Radharani's water sports in Vrindavan, he relished watching her splash about in the Yamuna with Krishna and her intimate gopi friends. But in the middle of her playful dealings, her nose ornament fell into the dark blue waters, and only Rupa Manjari noticed that it had fallen from her moon-like face. At this point, Rupa Manjari winked at Guna Manjari, or Gopal Bhatta Goswami in the material world, who, knowing the mind of Sri Rupa, dove in to look for the lost nose ring. Manjari searched the transparent waters in vain, however, because the blessed ornament could not be found. Guna Manjari had even engaged Mani Manjari, or Srinivas himself, in the search, but to no avail. Srinivas continued his meditation on this pastime, day and night, for 3 days without a break. However, in the external world, his wives were now beside themselves with grief. One said, "Will Srinivas ever come out of this meditative trance? Is he dead?" His body had become stiff, and his breathing was slight. His wives started to cry out loud. Soon the king came running, and when he observed Srinivas's condition, he too was deeply concerned. He said, "The body requires food. If the Acharya does not soon return to our plane of existence, he may permanently leave us." Nonetheless, the king consoled himself and Srinivas's wives when the court physicians examined Srinivas's body. It was still in a healthy state. But how long can even the healthiest man exist without food? Of course, it might be prudent to note at this point that such states of exalted consciousness are rare, and one should not attempt to imitate them. According to the Vedic tradition, those who are in the neophyte and intermediate stages of devotional service, bhakti yoga, should concentrate on required vidhi sadhana under the direction of a bona fide spiritual master, and it is by this method that one can gradually attain the higher levels of bhava and prema as exhibited by Srinivas Acharya. Ishvari, Srinivas's first wife, thought of Ramachandra Kaviraj. If anyone could understand Srinivas's state and bring him out of it, it was Ramachandra. She expressed these thoughts to the king, who quickly sent for Srinivas's most intimate disciple. After some time, Ramachandra arrived, and seeing the face of his lord and master, he assured everyone, "Do not fear. Srinivas Acharya is in a deep state of samadhi. He will soon return to you." Ramachandra, who was also the embodiment of Mani Manjari, although he is more commonly known as Karuna Manjari, sat next to Srinivas in a meditative trance. In this state, he appeared at the Yamuna where Srinivas, as Mani Manjari, was still looking for Radharani's nose ring. Ramachandra, in his own ontological form as Mani Manjari's other self, jumped in the river and helped Srinivas find the ornament, which was hidden under a lotus leaf. Giving the nose ring to Mani Manjari, Srinivas, Ramachandra was happy to assist his guru in this confidential way. At this time, Radharani finished her water sports, and she began to dress in her beautiful dark blue sari. Her intimate gopi friends naturally assisted her, and when there was one last ornament to place on her person, the nose ring, Guna Manjari confidently looked to Mani Manjari, who, in perfect timing, came out from the Yamuna and delivered the desired apparel. As the finishing touch was placed on Radhika's body, Krishna came to scurry her off into the forests of Vrindavan. The gopis and Manjaris watched in disbelief, mesmerized by the unparalleled beauty that emanated from the divine couple. The scene engulfed them with intense love, and their bodies showed symptoms of spiritual ecstasy. Just then, Ramachandra Kaviraj broke his meditation, as did Srinivas. They turned to look at each other once again in the external world. Laughing like madmen, they embraced and fell to the floor, their eyes emitting tears of love. King Birambir was never more ecstatic. His master had come back. Ishvari and Gauranga Priya cried tears of joy. All the devotees began to chant, "Hari, Hari!" A huge feast was brought in for the two sadhus who had just returned from an expedition in consciousness, an esoteric journey to the spiritual world. The feast remnants were given to the inner circle of Vishnupur devotees. After eating, the devotees sat at the feet of Srinivas and Ramchandra, who began to talk about the pastimes of Radha and Krishna throughout the night. Srinivas developed his inner meditation to such a degree that he began to inadvertently bring tangible paraphernalia from these meditations when returning to external consciousness. For example, Bhakti Ratnakar relates that once, while meditating on Mahaprabhu's Leela, Srinivas saw that he was actually worshipping Lord Chaitanya himself, who was seated on a beautifully jeweled throne. In Srinivas's meditation, he approached the Lord and reverentially anointed his body with fragrant sandalwood paste. Then he placed a garland of aromatic flowers around the Lord's neck and began to carefully fan him with a chamara whisk. As Srinivas served the Lord in this way, he could not keep his composure, and, looking at the Lord's magnificent form, he began to exhibit ecstatic symptoms. This pleased Lord Chaitanya, who then took the same garland of flowers that Srinivas had given him and placed it around Srinivas's neck. After the Lord made this loving gesture, Srinivas's meditation broke, but the garland was still adorning his own chest. Its fragrance was unlike anything he had ever experienced. He quickly took off the garland and hid it in order to conceal this confidential pastime. This same kind of Manasa Seva experience often occurred for Srinivas in relation to Radha Krishna Leela as well. Bhakti Ratnakar describes that once, during Srinivas's intense meditations, he envisioned himself as Mani Manjari at the side of Radharani as she and Krishna were taking part in the holy Kala festival. This is a joyous event wherein Radha and Krishna playfully throw colored dyes at each other. Srinivas saw in his meditation Radha and her intimate gopi friends flinging dyes and squirting all kinds of colored waters at Krishna, bombarding him from all directions. And he in turn threw various kinds of dye at them. As this loving battle reached its highest point, the gopis looked over at Srinivas, Mani Manjari, gesturing that he should come to their rescue. Mani Manjari then started to quickly supply Radhika with ample quantities of multicolored powders. Radhika and the gopis used these against Sri Krishna, but he would not be defeated so easily. He returned their attempts with even greater attacks, the conflict becoming so furious that the ground began to shake. In the midst of this irrepressible enjoyment, Srinivas's meditation broke, and when he returned to external consciousness, he realized that his body was covered with the multicolored dyes from the spiritual world. When his family and disciples saw him in this condition, they realized the perfected nature, or siddha, of his inner meditation, or manasa seva. The activities of Srinivas Acharya can fill volumes, and they have, but our objective is to present an overview of his life and accomplishments. Our work is hardly exhaustive. Details abound in the Bhakti Ratnakar, Prema Vilas, Narottam Vilas, Anuraga Bali, and Karnananda. This latter work gives a brief summary of his daily life in Vishnupur, as well as the similar routine he followed upon his return to Jajagram. According to that text, in the early morning he would read from the following books, explaining and interpreting them for his disciples: Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Vidagdha Madhava, Lalita Madhava, Hari Bhakti Vilas, Hangsaduta, Gitavali, Shatsandharva, Bhagavatam, and Brahma Sangita. The study of these books would occupy him until 10 o'clock in the morning. Then, until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he would chant his japa in solitude, occasionally worshipping Krishna according to his inner meditation. From 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the evening, he would perform kirtan, song and dance, with his disciples. The particular form of Padavali kirtan, for which he became famous, is called Manohar Shoy, and some say that it is the only authentic classical style that has survived. For his own kirtans, he would generally select songs from the varied repertoire of Jayadev Chandidas or Vidyapati. At night, he used to instruct his disciples and discuss esoterica with them. It is said that Srinivas composed only five lyrical padas. These are included in chapter 6 of Karnananda, three of which are also found in Padakalpataru. In addition, he wrote an excellent commentary on the Chatur Shloki of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is respected and studied to this day. And he wrote other works as well, including his famous Shat Goswami Ashtakam, eight prayers to the six Goswamis. While his literary work is not voluminous, its quality in terms of content and writing style is nectarine, leaving an indelible and unique mark on the Gaudiya tradition. Just as the authorized biographers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not mention in any detail his passing from this world, so too did Srinivas's followers neglect to tell us the story of Srinivas's disappearance. This may be due to their intense love for the Acharya and to their deferential conception that he was Mahaprabhu himself. Such conclusions are alluded to in Prema Vilas, which opines that Srinivasacharya was 1/16th part of the full spirit of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He was thus a special manifestation of the Supreme in the guise of his own devotee. Although his divine ascension remains a mystery, his life remains an inspiration.